Hello everyone, and a very warm August welcome back to Footprints. This month, after the students have all gone off to take a well-earned break, I took the opportunity to explore both of Bath's relatively new, by some standards, universities. Each of them sits in a unique landscape. The University of Bath is high up on Claverton Down. It's a modernist 1960s campus surrounded by open skies, mature trees and sweeping views. And down below in Newton St Lowe is Bath Spa University, a former country estate with lakes, temples and a Capability Brown legacy. Both were once colleges, the first for science and engineering and the other for art and education, and both became universities within living memory. We'll meet a wildlife conservation student and hear from a zoology lecturer at the beautiful Newton Park campus at Bath Spa University, and we'll dig down into the history and architecture of the University of Bath. Let's start with the newest one, Bath Spa University, and let's find out more about what goes on there with Ralph Thompson. Ralph is the senior lecturer in zoology and the programme leader for wildlife conservation. Here he is. Tell us where we are.
So we're sitting by the upper lake on Newton Park in a building sometimes called the Orangery or the Temple. It's a remnant of the estate that used to be here, and looking out over the lake with the birds singing around us. So this is the main campus of Bath Spa University, where we teach most of our degrees.
It's an extraordinary place, isn't it? I don't think there's another campus like it. Tell us the origins of it.
So originally it was a private house, so before that there was a medieval estate attached to the Newton St. Lowe, the village next to us. And that came into the ownership of the Duchy of Cornwall, the Prince of Wales's estate, and in the post-war period became a teacher training education college. And then later on that joined with the Bath College of Art or the Academy of Art, and became eventually in 2005 Bath Spa University. It's been through kind of various different stages, but the grounds that we're sitting in now were created according to a plan by the famous landscape architect Lancelot Capability Brown. So it's a registered historical landscape because it's thought to be one of the most intact of his designs. It hasn't been changed over time as much as some of the others have.
We just walked here down quite a steep hill from the main house to the end of the lake and then up to this building that we're in now. And it's like being in a National Trust property, isn't it? It's like being at Prior Park.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that draws people to study or to work here, is you can walk around and it feels like you've gone out for the weekend. You come and have a picnic here by the lake. Or if you want to relax and de-stress, come for a walk around the lake or through the woods. So for everyone who works here, lives here, studies here, it has that kind of relaxing atmosphere, but also particularly useful for those of us who are working in the ecological side, because we can also use the environment, the grassland, the lake, the woods, as examples of habitats that we can study and do bits of field work in as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just think about the wildlife for the moment. To start with, what might we see here?
So from where we're sitting now, looking down over the lake, we have a resident pair of swans that most years will breed. They'll nest in the reeds just below us. We've just walked past a coot nest as well. We have moorhens, mallards. We get occasionally dab chicks, sometimes little egrets visiting, and in the trees on the other side of the lake there are heronries, so there's a breeding group of heron nests up there. They're particularly loud in the morning. In the daytime they're a bit quieter, but they get very raucous early in the morning.
It's fabulous, isn't it? And the students live here, so they're living in this landscape, they're living amongst this nature.
Yeah, so we've got two sets of accommodation at the two ends of campus. One that we call the lakeside, looking out over the lower lake, and then the other one, the gardens accommodation up near the walled gardens, and looking out over Park Woods, where we have some more wildlife. We have badgers and foxes that we see going around there, a lot of small birds, and then out into towards the Wainstike off campus, we sometimes see barn owls foraging, flying over the rougher grass, so some of our students can see those from their bedroom windows in the evening.
Tell me about the slow worms.
Yeah, so we have, this summer, we did a survey with Wessex Water. They came to campus because last summer, when they were doing some development work in Saltford, they caught any slow worms or other reptiles they found and brought them to campus because it was identified as having a suitable habitat that could take some more. There's a heron just flying past there. That could take some more reptiles. And they came back this year to do a survey where we put out black tiles that heat up in the sun, and that makes a good place for them to gain heat because they take heat from their environment. They don't generate it in their bodies. So we leave them out, go back a little bit later, lift them up and see what's under there. And we found a lot of slow worms, so more than they brought last year, and also quite a few grass snakes. So good, healthy populations there. And that was up on the end of campus where we also have two ponds that were specifically designed as good habitats for newts. And so also during the spring and early summer, we've had surveys for newts happening with our ecological consultants and found, again, good healthy populations of all three native species of newts, the protected and rare great crested newts, as well as smooth and palmate newts. And as well as being a good indication of the health of the ecosystems that we have on campus, it's provided opportunities to our students to learn these kind of surveys with professional ecologists when they come to campus, and then the students help them with those surveys.
So they see what they're doing in the world of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so getting that kind of hands-on experience, and also is really useful just to get to talk to the ecologists and spend time working with them, talk to some of the graduate ecologists about how they got into work and what it's like to work in that area. And then some of our students will go on to work as ecological consultants. And actually some of the, at least two of the consultants that came to campus, one from Wessex Water and one from Nicholas Pearson's, are Bathspar graduates. So they've come back to the campus that they studied at, and they're now part of that team checking up on the wildlife here.
That's really nice, isn't it? And we're going to meet a student, Evie. And Evie has done a dissertation on bats. Tell me about the bats that live on campus.
Yeah, so we have a good habitat here for bats because of the range of things that we have on campus. So we have the lake, which is good for insects, and then the bats like to eat the insects. We've got woodland, and we've got open spaces, and different species of bats will prefer different areas, and that's what Evie's dissertation is about. She's been putting bat recorders out on different parts of campus to see which bats, which species she can record in different areas. So in the woods, in the open areas, and next to the lake. In particular here, we have an important roost of lesser horseshoe bats. And this is a maternity roost, so one where they bring up their young. And we think they're also using it over the winter as well. And that is in the Castle Gatehouse, which is a scheduled ancient monument. It's one of the oldest buildings that we have on campus. It's a medieval building. And although it's been renovated, when it was renovated, a specific roost was built into it because there were already bats living there. And so because it has thick old stone walls, it provides the stable temperatures that they need. So normally they will roost in caves, which have a good stable temperatures, but a big old medieval stone building gives that same kind of environment that they need.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that's why they live in the caves, Ralph Allen's caves, the Bath Stone Caves.
Yeah, so if you go in the caves over winter, they'll stay warmer. In the summer, they'll stay cooler. So being nice and deep underground, it saves them from the temperature extremes. They don't want to get too cold, but they also don't want to warm up at the wrong time of year, because then they'll become active and waste energy when there's no food around.
Clever. That is so clever. So this landscape that we're looking at out here, this stunningly beautiful landscape is not actually how it was centuries and centuries ago, because it's been sculpted a little bit and designed by Capability Brown, as you said. So what do we need to do now to keep it looking like this?
Yes, yeah, so that's right. This is a partially natural landscape. So it feels like it's quite a natural environment, but it is created, particularly the lakes have been created by damming of the Causton Brook, which originally ran through here and still feeds the lake. And there was quite a lot of upkeep to maintain that, particularly with the lake. A few years ago, there was a very big project to dredge the lake because it had silted up over time. And that would just naturally happen because if you leave it, it will return to what it used to be. It would become a small channel. And that was starting to happen. So we had to have big machinery in to dig out the lake and keep it looking as it is now, as a kind of pleasure ground. But we've also built a silt trap to try and prevent the need for that in future. The grassland has to be managed, so a lot of it is grazed by sheep. There's a local shepherd who brings sheep in, and other bits are cut. And when making decisions about things like when to cut the grass, there's a lot of different things to consider about the timing of flowering and seeding of particular types of plants. So we want to increase the diversity, encourage wildflowers, so try to delay the cutting until they've flowered, they've spread their seed, and then cut them off. And different plants will benefit from different kinds of management. And we have different areas of campus that have different management as well. The trees are also carefully managed so that we have trees, but they are allowing us to see through gaps in particular places. So we get nice views from up at Main House or from the end of the lake looking down. And then there's also things like the daily planting. Over in the wall garden, we've got the more kind of formal gardens, but with a focus on providing food, because that was the original purpose of the wall gardens, to provide food for the house. And the grounds team have planted Belgian hedges of apple and pear trees. So a whole row of each tree is a different variety of apple or pear. And we're just getting them to the size when they can start producing fruit for us now. So we'll be able to walk down and try out all the different varieties. There's also an allotment there which is used by the Student Gardening Society. So the students who live here and who study here can get the opportunity to grow some of their own food as a kind of therapeutic activity, as well as, you know, a way of understanding where the food comes from and hopefully getting to enjoy eating what they've produced. We also have a biodiversity action plan on campus. So that is our grounds team with our ecological consultants coming up with ways to improve the diversity of wildlife on campus. We have some specific species that are focused on, like the great crested newt and the bats, as they are protected species. But often what we do for the newts is also good for other wildlife. So say leaving areas of long vegetation for the newts to go through is also very good for other kinds of wildlife. A lot of that is seeded with flowers, so that's good for pollinators. And then the seeds stay on into the early winter, and the finches eat the seeds. So there's a lot of different practices that are aimed at both the human use of campus and the wildlife, and obviously people enjoy the wildlife as well. So keeping it as a functional university space, as a leisure facility or somewhere that's just nice to walk around to feel relaxed, and that's really important for the students and staff here as well, and also good for wildlife. So we have nest boxes up. We work with the Bird of Prey project out in Newton St. Lowe, who have nest boxes also in the fields around. So obviously a lot of the birds that are here won't just be on campus, they'll be going to other places as well.
So that's quite a balancing act, isn't it? Managing a space that's for the public, for wildlife, a conservation site. That's a lot of different needs and tensions, I imagine, to keep in balance.
Yeah, so that's a big task for our grounds team. They have a number of different action plans. They've got their biodiversity, they've got their historic environment. The Duchy of Cornwall has to agree to what we're doing because they're the landowners that we lease from. Has to be useful for the students, for the university. We also have a lot of people coming to visit the campus just recreationally. So they might enjoy walking their dogs around, but we want to make sure they're not disturbing the birds on the lake or nesting nearby. And some of what we do with our research project on campus is trying to look at the effects of human activity on some of the wildlife. So say, is there more wildlife activity further away from the paths, that kind of thing. And we do have some long-term monitoring of wildlife as well. For 20 years, we've had moth trapping on campus, monitoring the changes in the species, and that tends to reflect the national changes, where we've seen some of the species that used to be here disappearing and some species that weren't here before arriving largely in response to climate change. So those kind of annual or long-term data sets are really useful for understanding what's happening, and so we kind of remember what the campus has been like and see what's new and if anything's been lost.
That's really fascinating. Thank you so much for showing me around and bringing me down to this beautiful part of the university, but within sight of the main building. It's an extraordinary place that you work.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, when I came here, that was a large part of the reason for coming here. And I think that's the same with a lot of people. You know, Bath as a city is attractive, as the World Heritage City, but this is... It feels like a bit of a sanctuary outside the city and a place where we can separate ourselves to some extent from the rest of the world and relax and just focus on what we're doing here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Ralph Thompson there. Now, he mentioned one of his students and we're going to meet her next. She's called Evie de Gryther and she's just finished her degree at Bath Spa University, getting a first in wildlife conservation. We met her in the middle of the walled garden by the newt pond. So here we are at the pond. Just describe the pond for us. It was quite windy.
Okay, well, it's a reasonably sized pond, bigger than you'd get in your garden, probably. There's a lot of weeds growing in there, which isn't a bad thing because newts need to lay their eggs on leaves, so that's good. Yeah, lots of vegetation going on, some lily pads, which is always nice. And yeah, I can see several snails, which is always fun to spot the snails.
Yeah, look, there's a snail. I wouldn't have seen that if you hadn't pointed at it. Oh, and there's a butterfly.
Ah, good. Lovely butterflies.
Is there anything else that lives in here apart from newts and snails?
Well, you get quite a lot of insects, water boatmen, that kind of thing. I myself have never seen a frog or a toad. That doesn't mean that they're not here. And I did just see a damselfly go past just then. Yeah.
It's such a beautiful place to come and do a degree. You've got this pond right in the middle, surrounded by benches, surrounded by gardens, surrounded by greenhouses, and a beautiful walled garden with an awful lot of fruit trees against them. Picnic tables, table tennis tables, and a netball court.
Yes, we're definitely very lucky with the facilities that we have here, especially if you are studying something like wildlife or environmental science. But just for everyone, like, everyone enjoys using the outside space just to hang out, or recharge. And we are lucky to have such a good space, definitely. And what's so good is that we can do a lot of our field work just on campus, so we don't have to travel anywhere. And so we'd be, you know, in the lab and our lecturer would teach us about a surveying technique and then we could just go outside and practice it. For example, kick sampling for invertebrates in the stream. So yeah, it's been amazing just to be surrounded by wildlife whilst learning about wildlife has been very positive, yeah.
Did you choose this for the course or did you choose this for the wildlife and the nature?
Well, definitely a combination of the two. The course I really, really did like the look of because there was loads of science, but it also had some more creative, interdisciplinary kind of themes, which I really liked. But also, once I came and visited here and saw the campus, I was like, yes, this is the one. Yeah.
And you spent the first year here on campus. What was that like?
Oh, it was lovely, yeah. So I lived, on campus in accommodation for the first year. And it was great to just, be surrounded by the wildlife. And then between lectures or just, you know, if it was a stressful day, you could just take yourself into the woods and watch the birds for a while. And, it was a nice and peaceful place to live, definitely.
Tell me where we are now.
So at the moment we're in the walled garden, which is a really nice space, and it has a mix of things. So we've got the netball courts here, but we also have the herb gardens, the greenhouse, and students are encouraged to be involved with that. So we've got a gardening society who do a lot of good work with that. And we also have a lovely newt pond right in the middle.
I saw the newt pond as we came past. Tell me about that and your involvement in it.
So we're really lucky on Newton Park campus to have all three species of newts that live in the UK on our campus. So we have the common smooth newt and the palmate newt and the great crested newt as well. And the great crested newts are quite rare, so that's exciting. And every so often they do official surveys with newt licensed workers, and the students can get involved with that. So in my first year, we had to get up really early at 7 o'clock because the traps had been put the night before. You can only leave them for a certain number of hours so they don't get stressed. And so we got up really early and came to see what we'd found, and we were able to look at the newts, and the newt worker told us all about them, and it was really nice to see them up close because you don't normally get to.
In a previous episode, I watched Bathscape's Lucy do a newt survey at Bath City Farm, and all three newts were present then. That was really exciting. So, Evie, tell me about your dissertation.
So my dissertation was about bats and acoustic monitoring to identify what bat species use the campus. And so I spent the summer before my dissertation putting up lots of bat detectors all summer in various habitat types on campus. And we're really lucky on this campus to have like quite a mosaic of habitat types, which is really good for bats because different bat species use space in a different way. And so we've got our woodlands, we have our water bodies and our parkland. So in theory, we knew it should be a good place for lots of bats. We've had some bat surveys done here before in certain areas, but we've not really had like a comprehensive overview of everywhere. So I guess, yeah, trying to contribute to that. And I was looking at what species were there and also where they were foraging. So when a bat echolocates, when it tries to capture an insect, it makes like a little buzz kind of sound. And you can count the number of buzzes that appear in a sound recording, and you can use that to kind of guess or like estimate which places they're foraging in more. And so, yeah, I found 15 species of bats in total.
15? How many species are there in total anyway?
Well, there's 18 resident in the UK and 17 breed here. So it is an exciting number, but it's not unexpected because of the space, because of where we are, yeah.
That's really exciting. I mean, I can only think of three different sorts and you've found 15.
Yes, well, I mean, there's 15 total, but about 80% of the echolocation calls were from four species. So they were definitely the most common ones. And most of them were from pipistrelle bats, which soprano ones and common pipistrelles, and they're the most common in the UK. So I did have lots of recordings of Dorbenton's bats and whiskered bats down by the water bodies, because Dorbenton's especially, they pick their prey up directly from the surface of the water. So it would make sense that you would find them there.
Dorbenton?
Dorbenton's, yes.
I never heard of that. Dorbenton and whiskered. I'd like to know what a whiskered bat looks like.
Very, very cute, quite small, brown. Yeah, it doesn't have long whiskers like you might imagine, but it looks similar to, kind of similar to a Dorbenton's, I suppose, and the other Myotis bats that it's in a family with. Yeah, my visual identification of bats isn't as good because I spent all my time listening to them rather than looking at them.
Did you find horseshoe bats?
Yes, yeah. Not as much as I would have hoped, because we know that we have maternity roost of lesser horseshoe bats on campus. So I was hoping to kind of find out where they're travelling to forage, like where they're off to. But I only got very few recordings of lesser horseshoe bats out and about. And we know they're here, so either I wasn't recording in the right places or the detectors weren't picking them up, which is a possibility because they echolocate at quite a high frequency and quite quietly, so they're one of the harder species to detect.
Did you find anything surprising?
Not particularly surprising. All of my results were kind of consistent with previous literature. I was really excited to find that the common pipistrelles were mostly foraging in the woodland, whereas the soprano pipistrelles were mostly foraging by water bodies. These two species are almost identical, and the only thing they differ in is echolocating at a very slightly different frequency. But in nature, two species can't use the space in exactly the same way because one would outcompete the other eventually. So my research kind of implied that they're like partitioning resources. So the common pipistrelles are using the woodland and the sopranos are using the water bodies more. And that's a pattern that's been found by previous studies, but it's something that, yeah, if I could do a master's, it would be an amazing thing to expand on that specific area.
So bats is your thing. You're going to carry on with bats?
It sure seems like it at the moment. Yes. Yes. No, I'm a big bat fan. And yeah, it's amazing when you really get immersed in the study of something, you learn a lot and get very excited about it.
Of all the bats, which is your favourite? Which would you most like to research?
My favourite bat? Oh my goodness. That is a good question. I have a soft spot for the Dorbenton's bats, just because I think they're adorable and they have their big feet. Yeah, so I do like them, a big fan. And also I do love the lesser horseshoe bats, just because we have them here. But all bats are great.
Evie, congratulations once again on getting a first in wildlife conservation. The world is your oyster.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for having me. This has been really lovely.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, thanks so much to Evie there. And if bats fascinate you, then you can go on a bat walk with our very own Dan Merritt in episode 22, Bath at Night. Let's head up now to the top of Coombe Down and explore the other university campus, the University of Bath. It started life in 1966 as Bath University of Technology and was renamed the University of Bath 5 years later. It has four faculties, engineering and design, sciences, humanities and social sciences, and the School of Management. It's grown from a student population of almost 1,500 in 1966 to just under 20,000 students now. Professor Marion Harney kindly agreed to show me around, and we managed it with Badger the dog in weather, which changed from hot sun to torrential rain and with a lot of wind in between. Here she is to introduce herself.
I'm a professor of building and landscape conservation here at the University of Bath, and I'm associate dean for education for the Faculty of Engineering and Design. But one of my other roles, which I'm very proud of, is that I'm chair of the Bath World Heritage Site Advisory Board. And so I help to make those links between the university and the city, and that, you know, we have that continual exchange and engagement between the students and the city of Bath. The original campus design was by Robert Matthew Johnson Marshall and Partners, colloquially known as RumJohn. So it's designed as a megastructure which deliberately separates people from traffic. So as I said, the basic structure, the framework, is an extendable raised pedestrian spine running east-west, and the pedestrian deck is separated vertically from a central road at ground level. So the road and all the services run beneath the campus here. So there's no traffic on the top whatsoever.
It's really quite striking being up above everything. There's stairways going down to everything, aren't there?
Down onto everything. So it's in quite a nice elevated position, which is great. All of the entrances into departments are on the parade here. And beyond that, there's all the services like teaching labs, laboratories, staff offices and everything else.
Marion, this is a campus university. I don't know when the first campus university was built, but this may be one of the early ones.
Yes, it is. I mean, these were all built in the 1960s. And there was 8 built at the time.
And has there been research that shows what the impact on student living is and student life is living in a campus university?
I'm not sure if there's been much research done, but I went to Bristol University which was a college university, and there was no campus. The difference is it's much more collegiate here. I used to go to my lectures in Bristol, and the only people I ever saw were the people who were in my cohort. Here, you see every student who's anywhere on campus doing any subject whatsoever. The only time you passed a student in Bristol was on College Road, as they all disappeared into separate houses. So from my point of view, I haven't interviewed students about it, but from my point of view, it's a much more collegiate, and it's much busier, it's much friendlier, it's, you know, the place is populated the whole time, belonging at Bath, the kind of strapline we had, belong at Bath, and the campus very much represents that, where it's a place where everyone comes together, staff and students, because we're all going between lecture theatres and cafes and shops, and it's like living in a small town in a way that you don't get from living in colleges. But as if we look at the library, which is at the heart of the university, and we just briefly pop into the library, because I just want to show you the Pitman printing press that the library holds.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, let's. Okay. We've got Badger the dog with us today, so I hope he's allowed in the library.
Well, I'll just flash my card and we'll try and get past security. Let's hope we will. So here we've got the Pitman printing press. So the Pitman collection is housed in the library's archives and research collections, and it includes the death mask of Sir Isaac Pitman, inventor of the globally successful shorthand system, as well as a wax cylinder recording of his voice made in 1891.
Marion, what do you mean by the death mask?
It's a mask made on their deathbed, where so it has the impress. It's like not quite a shroud, but it's a mask of his face, so that you can see what Pitman looked like in real life.
In real life, but on his deathbed.
On his deathbed, yeah. It was quite a common practice, I think, at the time. Though I don't think many people do it now. Thank God.
It's an amazing piece of engineering, but it's quite ornate, isn't it?
It's got the obvious
printing press bit. You know, it's got a very, very heavy weight, which will land on the paper, but it's got ornate legs. It's got an eagle on top of it, and I think possibly a snake, is it?
It looks like a snake, yeah, wrapping itself around there.
And they're all picked out in gold, so it's black and gold.
Yeah, it's an impressive piece of equipment. You know, when you think about it, it was a very important piece of equipment at the time, because obviously printing presses were how everybody got their information. You know, the printed word long before we came into computers and everything else. So it's a very early piece of history about printing, and particularly printing in Bath. So we're very lucky to house that here as well.
There we go. We'll go
at
that.
Oh. This way, darling, this way. Where are we going now? Marion, this is a completely different feel out here. We've come out of the kind of urban, towny structures.
And we're into a beautiful landscape
with trees and grass and beautiful flowers, and the structures are behind us. We're just walking around the bottom of 4 South, which was the original, the OG building before the superstructure was built, where we started. It's now the Department of Life Sciences, and it's got a beautiful vine growing all the way along its length.
So the building to our left here is quite recent. It's the Milner Centre for Evolution by local architect Stride Treglown, and this was opened in September 2018 and is named after the University of Bath alumnus Dr. John Milner, who provided founding capital to establish the centre. This alignment wall that we're looking at on the side of the building looks like a piece of abstract art, but it's actually a series of colour-coded gene sequences showing the evolution from fish to humans.
No.
It is.
It looks like something I might put in my bathroom.
It is, but it's the actual gene sequence, fish to man.
This way, Badger. So just round the corner, literally a 2-minute walk from the original building, And here we are in front of this absolutely stunning lake.
The landscape was part of the original 1966 design for the entire university, so it's not coincidental or accidental that we have this lovely landscape here. Cotswold landscapes are typified by rolling green swaths of grass, white skies and distinct tree groups. And the original Rumjohn proposal was that the constructed landscape at the university, so it's very much a constructed designed landscape, should aim to preserve and accentuate those characteristics. Distinct but gentle slopes reminiscent of downland sheep walks, contrasting with the strong horizontals of the architecture, with emphasis and energy to the design by the tree groups. All the tree planting was initiated in 1967, and at the time it was ensured that at least 200 or 300 trees were planted every year in the early years.
Wow.
And the species all selected for their final mature effect, which we now have the advantage of looking at,
yeah,
60 years on. So the amphitheatre and this open-air theatre that we're looking at in front of us...
Do you know, I hadn't seen that till just now. It's cut into the grass, so it's not... There's no stone.
Proper amphitheatre. Yeah, you sit on the grass. It's tiered to sit on the grass. And this was deliberately designed as part of an invite-them-out campus policy over the years. And this theatre has become the venue for all sorts of formal and not so formal events. So yes, it's a beautiful setting. You see all the lovely lily pads and the flowers. And
the lily pads are beautiful, aren't they? And the dogs.
Oh, you're not happy sitting there. We're going to move again now.
Yeah, chasing the ducks.
Chasing
you are, Badger.
I'm sure they'll survive. I didn't know it was going to rain. I haven't even bought a coat. I was thinking we were into...
Well, it's not cold, is it? You don't have to go far to find a shelter, do you?
Yeah, we just go up to the moment.
This is the University of Bath Sports Training Village.
Just pop our head through the door and we can talk briefly about...
Oh, here is the Sports Training Village. Oh, it has smell of... sport, yeah, somehow, doesn't it?
That's all the gym.
There's the gym down there.
So you can see beyond that again, we're into double height spaces. So we've come in at first floor level, but if you see, there's all the courts and one thing and another over there. Right, so this is the English Institute of Sport at the University of Bath. So it's a regional centre with facilities for training world-class athletes.
Wow. It's quite a place, isn't it?
It's a huge magnificent history. And you can see why it encourages people to do their best. You know, it's got state-of-the-art facilities. And even the cafe here is really healthy. It only produces really healthy alternatives to food to give you stamina and nutrition.
And really, I feel like we could do the 100 metres here, Mary.
Well, you could do the 100 metres if you just run the length of this concourse. So it's quite... As I say, I like this building because it's on a heroic scale, with, you know, representing those achievements of sportsmen through the ages.
Tell me a little bit about that when designing a building, how much you want to put things like that into the design.
Well, I'm sure that would have been in the brief to the architects. What the architects would have been asked to provide is a building where, you know, it encouraged people to excel in their sport, you know, and give them the motivation of working in a lovely environment. It has to be a pleasure to come into, otherwise, you know, it's hard work going to the gym or doing lengths of a 50-metre swimming pool. So the building has to entice you in as well. And that's what good architecture and design does. It makes it a very welcome and enjoyable space to be in. And that feeling of light and space and health and well-being all helps to produce the best athletes.
Yeah.
Because of the weather, we won't go into the woodland walk, which is on the north side, because all of the halls of residence where the students live on campus are on the north side of there. And there's a fabulous woodland walk up there, which is home to all kinds of wildlife, roe deer, monkjack, foxes, are regularly encountered across the site. Hedgehogs have been spotted on campus. Badgers visit on occasion. A tawny owl lives near the medical centre down at the West End. And buzzards have been known to frequent the lacrosse pitch, while carp, koi ducks, frog spawn and herons populate the lake and ponds, as well as a huge range of garden birds. Peregrines sometimes visit to hunt, and woodpeckers can often be heard along the woodland wall. So, it is that emphasis on it being like a small town with all of the facilities of a town, but with easy access into a wonderful landscape as well.
Marion, thank you so much for touring me around this beautiful university and putting up with having Badger the dog interviewing you at the same time.
We only almost fell over a couple of times, so that was fine. But I'm used to dogs, so I've got two of my own. I'm well used to it.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you so much to those who took part, and you can find links to all the items in the show notes as usual. Do please email us with any suggestions or comments you have at info@bathscape.co.uk. We'd really love to hear from you. And don't forget, you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. Please, please share as widely as you can with your friends, family and colleagues. And for more information on Bathscape, visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer, and I'll see you next month.